Okay, so it's intimidating to talk in front of all these experts sitting right here, and I'm going to give a, so go easy on me. I'm going to give a fairly simple talk, although towards the end I'll move towards some topics of current interest to in our workshop. Okay, so quantum criticality. So solid-state physics has had a great deal of success in explaining properties of many materials, and the success is often based upon some simple ideas that we've now all learned very well, including the idea of, say, an order parameter. So, for example, like in a ferromagnet, you have the ferromagnetic order parameter, and then we can look at the excitations of a ferromagnet as small deviations of this order parameter. You can look at, spin transport in the ferromagnet by writing down equations, hydrodynamic equations for spin transport involving the order parameter. And so this has been a very successful paradigm in explaining many materials. Another idea that we use a lot is the idea of a quasiparticle. And the most successful instance of this is, of course, Landau's Fermi liquid theory. We start out with this picture of a metal as a gas of free electrons, and then look at the excitations of the gas as the excitations about a Fermi surface, and then find that the interactions between these excitations can be accounted for by dressing the bare electron with a cloud of particle hole excitations. But beyond that simple renormalization of what's called an excitation, you end up with a simple particle-like description of the low temperature properties of a metal, and then you can write down various transport equations for electrical conductivity, thermal conductivity, whatever you wish, and also understand in great detail the low temperature behavior of many of these transport coefficients. But what's become clear, in the last few decades of study of many interesting materials is that often these simple ideas just don't work, and there's a many mysteries, especially in the cuprates and the heavy fermion compounds, where it's not clear, how you could simply modify these paradigms to understand in some intuitive way the properties of the materials. So that's sort of the motivation as to why we want to look at somewhat more complicated many-body systems in which naive application of these ideas seem to break down. And one of the simplest ways to do that is to study quantum critical points, which are points at which phases of matter undergo transitions at zero temperature between two distinct states. So what I want to do today is just give you some simple baby examples of quantum critical points, describe some of their properties, and give you an indication how some of these properties may or may not generalize to more complicated systems. So here's sort of an outline. I'll begin really with something very trivial, but hopefully I'll convince you that even something this trivial, if you, when you study it carefully enough, there's much to be learned which generalizes to far more complicated systems. So I'll begin really with free fermions. Then I'll go on to dilute systems of bosons. So all of these have varying degrees of experimental applications, and I'll mention them briefly, we'll see that. But I won't go into that in any detail, at least in this talk. And then I'm going to talk about dense fermions, if you wish, dense bosons. In particular, you're going to put the bosons on the lattice, and we're going to distinguish cases where you have integer filling. And then fractional filling. Actually, I'm just going to mainly discuss the case of half filling, although in recent work with Leon, we've been looking at more complicated fractions, and there's a lot of interesting stuff about that. I'll be happy to talk to you in private. All right, so let me just start with free fermions, something that you all know very well, so it's kind of in this very knowledgeable audience, it would seem that I couldn't possibly say anything new about them, and that's probably true. But anyway, it is true. Okay. So here's just free fermion moving on some lattice, and let me just make them spinless. And then I also look at put in a chemical potential and then various interactions. Okay, so the question I want to ask, let's just, well, it's free, so there's no interaction, but we'll put the interactions in later. Okay. So this is a many-body system, but the many-body interaction is just the Pauli exclusion principle. And I want to ask about something about the ground state of the system. And in particular, I want to ask, is the ground state evolved smoothly as a function of parameters? And if there's a point where there's a non-analyticity, by definition, that's the point where there's a quantum phase transition between two distinct ground states. So in particular, I want to think about the free Fermi system at constant chemical potential. So now if I look at the ground state as a function of mu, oh, sorry. Of course, you diagonalize this Hopping matrix element, and then you get some dispersion spectrum for these fermions. And then you ask, how does the ground state of the system evolve as a function of the chemical potential? Well, the chemical potential is down here. I have no fermions at all. If the chemical potential is up here, then I have a finite density of fermion, which I fill up to some Fermi C. So if I plot the density of fermion as a function of chemical potential, n, and here's mu at t equals 0, and there's some critical chemical potential below which the density is 0, and above which it's non-zero. So the density definitely does not have a smooth evolution as a function of chemical potential, and this is really the most trivial example of a quantum critical point, but it does nevertheless have some rather interesting properties. So in particular, the density over here is some constant, in fact, just a universal number, in fact, which depends on the dimensionality, times the mass of the fermion times d over q, where the dispersion at the bottom is k squared over 2m. So knowing the curvature at the bottom of the band completely fixes, independent of the, the higher energy behavior, the entire dependence of density right here at this point. So now we have a transition between just empty space and filled space, and a filled band here of fermions up to the chemical potential. All right, okay. Now it's very useful to ask about how will you think about this system at finite temperature. So now let me take and draw this first example of a diagram I'll draw a lot of as a function of mu and temperature. What does the finite temperature property of the system look like? Well, if I'm down here at negative chemical potential, then at zero temperature, of course, I had no particles. But if my chemical potential was here, I'm going to get a small density of particles thermally excited because you're at finite temperature. And so here the density will be e to the minus mod mu over t. And more importantly, these particles essentially will look like classical particles because at this point, the spacing between the particle, which is exponentially large, is much, much greater than the de Broglie wavelength. So you have this regime where the vacuum is just empty, and if you want to look at properly the finite temperature, well, it's essentially a classical Boltzmann gas. If you put an interaction, then you'll have to account for the interaction in exactly the way that Boltzmann did that. Similarly, now let me look at the opposite regime at large mu. Here I've got a finite density of particles. And then if I look at excitations, these excitations are now, of course, excitations about these Fermi points with a linear dispersion. So you really have Fermi liquid behavior, if you wish, at least in dimension greater than 1. In one dimension, you have largest liquid behavior. And here, again, you would get a description in terms of quasi-particles of the interactions, which would be the Landau quasi-particle description. And what really makes Landau's quasi-particle description work is that, again, now the spacing between the quasi-particle at low temperatures is much larger, or at least the collision time between quasi-particles, which becomes extremely large near the Fermi surface, is much larger than the spacing between, the collision distance is much larger than the de Broglie wavelength of the quasi-particle. So you again have effectively a quasi-classical description, which was developed by Landau. However, you know, you can now ask, how do you go over from this kind of Boltzmann quasi-particle description to the Landau quasi-particle description? And it turns out that when you look at it more carefully, even in this very simple model, there's an intermediate regime, which I'll draw like this. And this I'll call quantum critical. And the, you know, one of the most important properties of the intermediate regime here is that the particle spacing, or particle collision length, is of, on the order of the de Broglie wavelength. So, you know, although these are free fermions, and you can really work things out in some detail, and in fact, you can formally show that all interactions that you add here are irrelevant at this critical point. So it's really, the whole theory is under good control, but you nevertheless have this intermediate regime where you don't have a quasi-classical description, where really the particle spacings are order of the de Broglie wavelength. And as we'll see, this kind of intermediate regime is characteristic of the quantum critical behavior of far more complicated models. So if I, in particular, if I sit in this regime and ask, as a function of temperature, how does it sit here, and plot the density as a function of temperature, well, that's going to increase with the power of temperature, with some constant C2, temperature to the power d over 2. And this number C2, of course, depends on the Fermi distribution function, and in fact depends on the whole distribution function, not, you know, the Fermi distribution function is a function of energy, you know, it looks something like this. This number depends on the integral of the whole curve, not something right near the Fermi surface, as is the case over here, where that's the important regime. Over here, the important regime is, of course, right at very low energies. This depends on the entire integral of the full Fermi function. It's easily computed, but it's still a universal number. And C2 and the ratio of C2 and C1 is also universal. And there's some, you know, nice crossover between this quantum critical behavior and the classical behavior that, of course, is fully encapsulated in the Fermi function. Okay. Yes. All right. And also, formally, you can show that all of these quote-unquote universal properties, the number C2, the number C1, the crossover, you know, so this is at T equals 0 at finite temperature. This singularity is going to be rounded out. And this behavior here is telling me, you know, what happens when I move up here at finite temperature. All of these features are universal features of this critical point in the sense that, independent of any short-range interactions I put in here, none of it's going to change. Those are all formally irrelevant. Okay. So that's, I'm using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. I'm just here taking something very trivial that you all know very well, but casting it in a language that we'll find reappears in far more complicated systems. I mean, the idea that you've got two phases with an effective quasi-classical description between them, and then some interesting intermediate quantum critical region where if you forced a particle description on it, you will always end up with the result that the spacing between the particles is on the order of the de Broglie wavelength. So that's why there's no...
But nothing non-analytic happens as you pass those cross lines.
Absolutely. So the only non-analyticity is at zero temperature. But nevertheless, there's the effect of this zero temperature critical point is felt then over this entire region at finite temperature. And in this region, you should really be thinking about excitations of the mu equals zero critical point.
But attractive interactions are irrelevant.
Formally relevant, but they'd be dangerously relevant, I guess. So if there's a superconducting phase here, then there'd be some TC coming in here, but that's really a property of the Fermi liquid fixed point, not of the mu equals zero fixed point. So the, in terms of RG, your flow is this way, and the attractive interactions are relevant about mu equals infinity, not about mu equals zero. So this behavior would still be the same. And we're going to see another, as you well know, another example of that behavior at the end of my talk.
But the transition will be the, from the...
It's spinless. There's no less way.
You can put in spins, it doesn't change anything.
There would probably be some first order transition. I don't know, maybe that's my
question. First order transition between what? This is the density is going to zero. I mean, and this is the, it's just a question of the density have a smooth on state or not. Well, if you have a bound state, then you got to then I would call the bound object my particle. Okay. All right. Well, I guess even in this trivial case, there are interesting subtleties. All right. So, can I go on? Or any questions on this stuff from other than the experts? Well, we're all experts on this. Yeah, Sandy.
I guess I don't understand why the de Broglie wavelength is comparable with particle spacing in that shaded in the middle region. Is it because the temperature's changed? Because the de Broglie wavelength goes like 1 over root 2.
Yeah, so does the spacing, because the density is also going as t to the d over 2.
Okay.
So things just kind of adjust them. I'm really thinking in terms of not... We are much more accustomed to thinking about this problem at constant density rather than constant chemical potential. So if I draw the contours of constant density here, there's something like this. So if you just raise the temperature at fixed density, you would cross between these three regions as you raise the temperature. Yeah.
You mentioned the interaction is relevant. So that's the same thing true for the spin 1/2 electron.
Yeah, it's true. At this mu equals zero critical point, every interaction that
could...
Oh, sorry. Hold on. Spinless is irrelevant. If you have spin below two dimensions, interactions can be irrelevant. In fact, that's the next point. You're right. I forgot.
So the attraction probably speaking irrelevant, marginally relevant for spin 1/2.
Yes, I was wrong. You're right. For spin 1/2. So Matthew, I think you're right.
Yeah, but 2 and below attraction.
2 and below attraction and repulsion are both relevant in
below.
2 and below.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you have spin.
No, even without spin.
Sorry?
Okay.
Without spin for what? Without spin, there's no contact term.
There's no contact term.
You always have some gradient in the quartic term.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the next point. I was going to go to bosons. So let me just do this. Look at the same problem and talk about bosons. And I'm going to call them capital B for reasons that become clear later. Okay. All right, but for bosons, of course, now I can't ignore the interaction at any level. I have to include them. So I put in a repulsive interaction, but I imagine, of course, more general problems with other possible interactions. So again, I can ask the same question, try to generalize this simple quantum critical point of free fermions to a system of Debye bosons. And you can see, of course, you can't draw this band structure, at least naively, but you still have the feature that for chemical potential mu negative or bottom or below the bottom of this band, it doesn't pay to have any bosons at all. And for mu positive, it does pay to have bosons. And so you can imagine, again, a non-analyticity at some critical value of mu between the empty state and the finite density state. And in fact, this behavior holds also for bosons, but with a small change that d has to be less than 2, as Matthew knows well. And again, this kind of crossover also holds completely in exactly the same way for d less than 2. So So again, sorry? Right, sorry. So I'm going to change that. Thank you. I want to change this. But the crossover diagram is essentially the same. So here you're going to get a superfluid. Well, if you're in one dimension, it's a Lorentz liquid, but let me put superfluid in quotes. So I imagine I'm between one and two, I suppose. But again, you get a classical description here where, of course, the statistics of the particles don't matter. And over here, you've got a finite density of boson that presumably Bose condensed, and then you have a superfluid description. But you have this intermediate quantum critical behavior with rather interesting properties, both in one dimension and two and three, and so on. Now, of course, so I do want to explain why this d less than two comes about. So to understand what happens, why d plays a special role, we really have to look at the effect of these interactions, right, at the zero density critical point. And the basic RG equation that you find is that as you change the scale, this goes as 2 minus du plus terms of order u squared and so on. So what you see from by looking at an RG analysis of this critical point is that for d less than 2, u flows to u star, some fixed point value for d less than 2, which is not equal to 0. Sorry, have I made a mistake anywhere? I think it's OK. Oh, yeah. No, this is mine. This is, yeah, there you go. And it goes to 0 for d, d greater than or equal to 2. Yeah. So this is, in fact, turns out to be the more interesting case from the sense of quantum criticality, because you now have these bosons at near the zero density critical point, which interact with each other, but the interaction has a universal strength. So one consequence of this is that if I look at this sort of crossover across from the dilute system to the dense superfluid system, and the interaction between all the excitations are determined by this fixed point value u star, and therefore are independent of all microscopic details. If I now go above two dimensions, then I do need to know what the bare value of u is. And for bosons, I'll then end up effectively with a recasting of the, you know, the Yang-Yang theory of the dilute Bose gas, the Yang-Li theory of the dilute Bose gas. I mean, you get very similar type behavior, but recast in a somewhat more complicated language. But for d equals 2 and below, this kind of approach is certainly very useful. And one of the things you can, in fact, show in more detail in d equals 1, that these numbers, C2 and C1, are the same fermions and bosons in one dimension. So in effect, what happens is that this u star effectively becomes infinite when the bosons are very dilute. And these dilute Bose systems then therefore interact, you know, very strongly. There's essentially a hardcore repulsion between the bosons at low momenta. And that effectively leads to the distribution function being given by a Fermi distribution function. So you get this fairly non-trivial result that for bosons in one dimension in this now very complicated regime about which we know very little even today, you certainly can at least, however, predict the thermodynamic properties, and in particular, the density of bosons in this regime would have this number C2 given by the Fermi distribution function. Okay, so now this particular example, before I do that, I want to give you a simple experimental motivation for studying this, and then I'll say a little bit more about the properties of this quantum critical region. All right, so. So. So one simple experimental system which realizes effectively bosons at constant chemical potential for which you can drive a transition just like this is provided by the spin gap compounds. And a simple example of that, I just draw as a caricature, is a spin ladder. So imagine we have an insulator made up of copper ions that form a ladder like this. And for the purpose of this talk, each copper is sitting on these sites and has just one electron. So there's one electron sitting on every site. With an antiferromagnetic exchange interactions along the legs and the rungs of the ladder. Now it turns out a caricature of the ground state of the spin ladder is if you imagine that the electrons sitting on the sides of the ladder form spin singlets. So each one of these ellipses represents a spin singlet combination of the two electrons on the copper ions. Okay. So this particular spin gap state, where all the electrons are paired into spin singlet, I'm going to think of as just this boson vacuum. And here, of course, the vacuum is trivial. There are no particles. Here I have a more complicated ground state, but it has a gap to all excitations. And I'm effectively going to map it on to this region here. Okay, now what are the excitations? What are my bosons here? Well, to create an excitation, I've got to take a spin singlet and break the bond. I'm going to get a triplet where the spins are parallel to each other. So if I plot the energy of this excitation, and I'm going to put a magnetic field here in a minute. So there's three states here corresponding to the SZ equals 1, 0, and minus 1 excitations across the rung of a ladder. If I now apply a magnetic field on the system, the ground state won't change. The ground state is a spin singlet, but these excitations will split apart. And eventually, and this magnetic field, which is coupled to this, just like a chemical potential for the bosons, this is effectively the magnetic field. Eventually, this particular spin 1 excitation, which is a boson, will eventually hit zero energy, and then the magnetization system will become non-zero. So this critical field, HC, is right here. And for N, you just read magnetization of the system. So you could take one of these one-dimensional spin gap compounds, put it in a magnetic field. What you'll observe is the magnetization at low temperature is essentially zero. And then beyond a critical field is an onset of magnetization, which is then given by this W Bose critical point. And the simple prediction of this theory would then be that these crossover functions, which you measure at finite temperature of the magnetization, should be given by just the Fermi distribution function. And that's indeed seems to work reasonably. Okay, but somewhat more non-trivially, you can now ask, how about the dynamic correlation functions of the magnetization, or really the Bose-Green's function, which can be measured by neutron scattering. So let me just say a little bit about that.
General, if you have any arbitrary spin model, like just give some complicated spin model,
yeah,
it would be a very educated guess of what maps onto what section of these Fermi boson model. Here you map this ground state onto the other point.
Well, I mean, there is no recipe. In this case, of course, the mapping to the boson model is evident. The fact that the critical point of the boson model is the same as a critical point. The Fermi model is somewhat non-trivial, and I haven't really explained in detail why that's the case. But if you just look at more carefully the properties of bosons and fermions in one dimension, becomes quite clear. That only happens in one dimension. It's not true above one dimension. So where was I? So now you can also look at correlation function of these bosons, in particular by measuring the transverse magnetization in neutron scattering. You can compute, you can effectively measure the boson Green's function, which I'll call chi of k and omega, which is basically the Fourier transform of a B dagger Green's function. And so this is, so what does this say? This, the neutron comes in, it creates a boson, creates one of these excitations. That excitation is not going to collide with any pre-existing excitations, and you have some complicated one-dimensional system to worry about at finite temperature. Now, if you were here, you could really work out what happens in a quasi-classical approach. If you were here, you can also work out using sophisticated one-dimensional techniques based on the Lagrange liquid what's going on. But in this intermediate regime, in fact, even today, we don't have any exact results, although the work of Kurepin provides some information. But you can at least roughly say how things will scale with temperature and frequency. In particular, you know, this susceptibility will be given by a response function, which will then scale as 1 over temperature. This just comes from this counting various scalar dimensions of these bosons at this critical point. But the kind of question you want to ask is, you know, what's, you know, how broad is this response function as a function of say, at, let me put the momentum equal to 0. As a function of frequency, you're going to get a response function of a certain width, and that width is going to be related to roughly the inverse of the collision time between the bosons. So you might expect that this response function is some function f of omega times some gamma, right? Omega over gamma, where gamma is some collision frequency of these bosonic excitations. Now, this is where the fact that the bosons are interacting with this coupling U, which I've erased, flows to a fixed point value U star. So naively, you would say, well, the collision frequency depends on the interaction between the excitations. But here, since the interaction has flows to a fixed point value, the collision frequency really doesn't depend on anything. And in fact, the only scale you have here, which is the spacing between the particles, which is related to the temperature, and therefore this collision frequency just becomes a universal number times kBT over h bar. And this is now a highly non-trivial universal number associated with this quantum critical fixed point of the dilute gas of boson at finite temperature. And we don't know what this number is. It's really very hard to calculate. Even numerically, it's not the kind of thing you can do very easily because it's a highly complicated analytic continuation that's required. And so there are some cases like the Ising chain where this number is known, but here we have no idea what it is. Something of order one, but it's, yeah.
Can this model map to three Fermi model?
It does map to three, yes.
So do we know that in one dimension?
No, we don't. Because there's a, you can write on a complicated expression for this involving non-local Green's function of fermions, but then this whole, you have to then evaluate this complicated Fredholm determinant, which is what Kurepin's book is about. But density correlation function you can do. There's certain asymptotics of this at small and low frequencies, but at high frequencies that are known. Kurepin has certain results at long time limit, but this is, well, so this is an important challenge, I think, to figure out these things for this very simple system, which can be measured experimentally.
Why does it map to free Fermi?
Yeah. Why is it Lettinger?
This whole line is Lettinger, but this endpoint is free fermions. So you have to distinguish this in one dimension. The whole line is a critical line here, but the endpoint has dynamic exponent z equals 2. The fact that the excitations have quadratic dispersion is absolutely crucial for determining, you know, this number and the other numbers, and also the value of gamma. You have to know about the bottom of the band. So it's not conformally invariant. It's not a conformally invariant critical point at all.
The density goes to zero at zero temperature.
That's right. But nevertheless, it's highly, as you can see, even starting with something this trivial, you immediately end up with questions that are extremely difficult to answer. And it's all a property of this strongly interacting quantum system in a regime where there's no quasi-classical description. In this case, we happen to know that, well, the excitations, there are these renormalized excitations, which are fermions. And furthermore, if you just took two isolated bosons, the S matrix is just minus 1. That's why bosons are mapping onto fermions. But beyond that, the many body physics of these fermions interacting with this minus 1 S matrix at this finite temperature leads to this relaxational behavior with a collision frequency related to KT, but we don't know what that number is. So yeah.
Spin-orbit cut plane relevant to
the point? Is this a joke? Okay. Spin-orbit coupling.
Does that violate conservation of bosons?
You're right. It is relevant.
Okay.
And then what happens is that you can get an Ising transition.
Okay.
You don't get, so absolutely, U1 symmetry is essential to have this critical point. So then there's more complicated crossover, in fact, where the density.
That was enough.
No, because that's a standard question. What about spin-orbit coupling? I thought you were trying to throw me.
No, I was asked this question by experimentalists.
Is that general, or does it depend where the minima band is?
Sorry, what's general?
The momenta of the minimum energy excitation is, maybe, relative to spin-orbit coupling?
We're in
very far field.
Yeah, well, it's just a question of whether you have U1 symmetry or not. The most important thing here is SZ. Everything here depends on the fact that mu, or the field, couples with something that commutes with the rest of the Hamiltonian.
But spin orbit involves,
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's possible to. If you have spin orbit, rather than going from zero to here, you're already non-zero. And then there can be some other Ising transition at this point. And for the Ising case, in fact, we know the analog of this number because of conformal invariance. So there is one and only one case, I think, where this kind of number is known, and that's related to cases where you can get the exact scaling function of the system at finite in a finite geometry using conformal invariance. But we don't have that here.
How are you defining gamma exactly? Sorry, I mean, you could pour that constant into the scaling function.
Well, it turns out because there's many ways of defining it. In this case, in fact, since there's no enormous dimension, even the scale is universal. So it's in fact the coefficient is universal. It's just you can say at small frequencies, 1 minus I omega over gamma plus order omega squared. In fact, gamma has both real and imaginary parts, because you don't have particle symmetry here. But it's just this omega over kBT times some universal number here. So that's one way to define it. Experimentally, this is very easy to measure. It's just the width of the neutron scattering peak that you would see in this region here. Okay. All right, so that's kind of an introduction to a simple quantum critical point, which you can see already leads to rather interesting behavior at finite temperature and very difficult universal questions for which we don't have complete answers as yet, which are also related to quantities you can measure in experiments quite easily, like this magnetization onset in a spin chain. Okay, so now what I want to do is continue with this boson system and look at somewhat more interesting critical points in some ways, for which we know even less, where the density of bosons becomes larger. And the fact that you're on a lattice is important. Over here, of course, the only thing that was important was the bottom of the band, the k-squared dispersion. But precisely which lattice you're on and how many bosons you've got relative to the number of lattice sites turns out to be extremely important, and I'm going to talk about two interesting cases, one of which is well understood from the work of Matthew, and the other one which we think we understand quite a bit more about, but still a topic of some discussion in this workshop. Okay, so any questions? How am I doing? Oh my gosh, how much time do I have, David?
20 minutes.
20 minutes, all right. Need this up there. Okay, so now let me take the same system, the same Hamiltonian, but I imagine I've turned mu large enough that the ground state has lots of bosons in it. And let's assume mu is such that the density of bosons now is fixed to be 1 per site. So B dagger I BI, or at least on average on all sites, is 1. And I want to ask for the ground state, as a function of mu. A function of u. So now I'm not varying the density, I'm just varying an interaction parameter, say the repulsion between the bosons. Okay, so this is, of course, a familiar case, many known to people in the atomic workshop too, because of these beautiful experiments in optical lattices, which explicitly realize this, although at a variety of fillings, and maybe even some at fractional filling that we are interested in. So for the case of integer filling, of course, as I think all of you know, you have a critical point at some critical value of u. And at small u, you have a superfluid ground state. This is the ground state over here on this side. And at large u, you have a very different ground state, which is dominated, of course, by the interactions. So if I'm on the square lattice, which I'm going to assume here, then when u is very large, you want to keep the bosons apart. If you have exactly one boson per site, there's a very simple way to do that. Just put one per site, and that's the minimum energy state. And this is obviously clearly not our superfluid. But now you want to address, of course, what happens at finite temperature above these states. And really the whole story, once you've got this story done, is almost the same, except you've got to change a bit what happens way down here. So now this region here is, of course, the small u region here. And you again accept some kind of crossover. This curve doesn't come in linearly anymore. I won't get into those details. But here at low temperatures, you would have, again, you know, superfluid heterodynamics, on which many textbooks have been written, and all of that will apply at low enough temperatures all the way up to the critical point. Correspondingly on this, how do I think about what happens on this side? Well, again, now I have to identify my excitations. And what are my excitations here? Well, to create an excitation about this insulating state, I got to maybe move a particle at fixed density, move a particle from here to somewhere else. So if I just draw a one-dimensional cross-section, you know, I could remove a particle from here and put it over here. So relative to the ground state, I have a hole here and a particle here. So these are my quasi, now I have really not two types of excitation. Even though I started out with just ordinary bosons, I have a quasi-particle excitation. This guy can move around freely. And this can also move around in a quasi-hold. So I have quasi-particle and quasi-hold, which are bosons. And it costs finite energy to create them. So at low temperatures, there's going to be an exponentially small density of them. And they're going to behave classically, because their spacing is going to be much larger than the de Broglie wavelength. So in fact, again, you're going to get this type of behavior, with the only difference being I've got two species, I've got two charges. But again, you would write on a classical Boltzmann equation and write on something about the collisions of these particles. And you know, Boltzmann would do a completely adequate description of the finite temperature property of this state and various transport response functions at low enough temperatures. And finally, then you'd have a regime like this, intermediate, the quantum critical regime, where if you insisted in thinking in terms of these quasi-particles and quasi-holes, which you can, it turns out, that's not an unreasonable description, because something called the anomalous exponents for these field operators is rather small. You would end up with a description in terms of these excitations, where, again, as before, the spacing is of order the de Broglie wavelength. And these statements, the general statements are made about relaxation rate being given by KT over H bar will again hold here, but the universal numbers will be different. And these are things you can attempt to compute by various epsilon expansions and so on, but you know, nothing is really very accurate. And hopefully, eventually, we'll have a better control quantitatively on understanding various transport and response functions in this intermediate regime. Okay. The trouble is, so what makes it hard in Monte Carlo? So you've got to do Monte Carlo in imaginary time.
Right.
And so the minimum frequency you have a response, a result is 2 pi kt.
I understand. The response functions are going to be hard, but at least correlation functions.
Equal time, yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah, Matthias has quite a few of them. all right. So now I want to get to the exotic part in the last 10 minutes. So.
Yeah. You mentioned you presume the superfluid phase.
Thank you. Thank you. There's a transition here, TKT. Yeah. But this TKT, I really view as a property of the U equals zero fixed point, and then it's really a property of this classical description that I would have used down here. It's the existence of this phase transition at finite temperature is, from the viewpoint of quantum criticality, is a bit of a distraction. It's really not a property of the, this critical point at all. Right, it comes into the scaling point, yes. Okay, what was I going to say next? Since I only, oh yeah. All right, so let me get down to the level of, you know, actual theory. So how does one compute this property of this critical point and possibly of the interaction between the excitation and this intermediate temperature regime? Well, one way to view this critical point is to start from here, from this insulating state, and where you have this gapped excitation, the particles and the holes. So you write down some theory for these gapped excitations. And as you approach the critical point, you know, the gap vanishes. So these will be my low energy excitations. And perhaps the condensation of these particles and holes is what I should then interpret as my superfluid. So that strategy, you know, works very well. So here you write down, since you have both particles and holes, these are described by a relativistic complex scalar. So these are the particles and the antiparticles. So we'll call it psi. And the theory for this just does become essentially the relativistic theory for a complex scalar in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Relativistic in quotes. Okay, so there's, in principle, the symmetry of the underlying problem also allows some first-order derivatives, but if you want a mod insulator integer filling, in fact, you have an insulator with exactly one particle per site, that has a consequence of prohibiting the first-order terms. Another way to see it in terms of particle-hole symmetry, so the relativistic invariance over the fact that particles and holes have the same energy. Right, absolutely.
And it becomes relativistic.
Yeah.
Because presumably there are triply occupied sites, so there's not
exactly. Yeah, you know. yes. Okay. So there are additional operators that break relativistic invariance, but which are irrelevant. Okay. So now. This picture of condensation of excitations also connects very nicely with sort of what we call the Landau-Ginzburg picture, because this psi can also be interpreted as a superfluid order parameter. So having psi non-zero is basically a characterization. It's the usual Bose-Einstein condensate. Of the existence of a superfluid here. Okay, so you could have also obtained this theory by thinking in terms of fluctuations in the Landau-Ginzburg style approach of the superfluid ordered state, which I think of an XY magnet. So I'm asking, how does an XY magnet disorder? And I could imagine writing down this kind of Landau theory, if you wish, for the fluctuations of the order parameter of an XY magnet. And that approach also, you know, it's another way of interpreting this theory for the critical point. Okay, so that's all a prelude then to now introduce some of the more interesting questions that are far from understood, where something even more subtle happens, where you now think about systems at fractional filling, and particularly I'm going to focus on half filling. So let me take P dagger B equals 1/2. And again, let me follow the ground state as a function of U. So I'm not even all right. So now it's small U, of course, I still have a superfluid. When I go to large U, I see a new important piece of physics emerging that I haven't seen in any of the models I discussed so far, which is that it's not so simple now to write down any unique ground state. In fact, we know there can't be for this system. So what would you do if you had strong interaction with boson that half filling? That's right. You'll become clear why. Sometimes in cases that can be very subtle, topological type degeneracy, but I'm not going to focus on that here. But the simple type of degeneracy you would get would come about from breaking of translational symmetry. So suppose I have twice as many sites as I have bosons, and I imagine there's some short-range repulsion between them. So one thing I could do is put bosons on every second site, and one simple way to do that is put them in a checkerboard pattern. So this checkerboard. And there's two ways of doing this. I can take this checkerboard or the other checkerboard, so there's at least a two-fold degeneracy. So now I have this strongly interacting state, which has this additional degeneracy, or more precisely in this case, a new order parameter. I have another broken symmetry, broken translational symmetry here. Because if I translate it by one lattice site, I don't get the same state back. And I have a new order parameter associated with that. So I started out with a superfluid state, which had the obvious superfluid condensate. And then I say, well, let me get rid of the superfluid. And what I get is something that doesn't happen, I think, as far as I know, generically, any classical system. I seem to be ending up with a quantum state where I need a new order parameter, even though, you know, it has really nothing to do with the absence of superfluidity. I mean, it's just saying psi equals 0 doesn't immediately tell me exactly how this symmetry is going to be broken. So to characterize this ground state, I need yet another long-distance characterization associated with the way I've broken translational symmetry that has nothing to do with psi. So really, I have two order parameters. And what Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory would say, if you have two order parameters, we'll just say, well, you either have a first order transition, or you have more than one transition, so greater than one phase transition. Well, from the point of view of quantum criticality, neither of these is interesting. If it's first order, well, then it's just boring. If there's more than one, well, then it seems that these two order parameters really become independent. Maybe at one of them, the superfluid disappears. The other one has to do with translational symmetry. So you could write down independent theories for the two transitions, which would be very similar to the kind of things I've already discussed.
Are there Monical calculations showing that for large U, then one does have this broken symmetry phase?
It's, of course, not generic. I'm just imagining there's all kinds of interactions. Yeah, all right. Okay, so for this particular, I mean, in fact, for this problem, we know very little for sure. But the question we've been exploring a lot is that, is there any way where generically over a whole regime of parameters, you could have a second order phase transition between the superfluid state and some odd insulator which breaks translational symmetry? And if you do, what is the nature of that transition? Clearly, if you had one, it violates, you know, the rules of Landau theory and on the different phases that you could have transition between.
Wasn't another possibility that the two order parameters are both part of some larger symmetry group when you have two symmetries breaking at once?
Well, there is no such symmetry in the Hamiltonian, and of course that's a possibility, yes. But then you have to show that it's stable and generic and so on. And we don't have such a scenario. Yeah.
Okay, so why would you expect this? I mean, you're saying that it goes against Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson paradigm.
Well, expect it to occur? Well, so we can construct an example, the level of field theory, where it does occur. And it also has very interesting properties in, which we hope are relevant to experiments. Okay, but let me just show, let me construct.
In this system.
I haven't specified the system very much. I haven't told you all these interactions there. So the reason we're looking for this is, I should say, as a preface, that there are many experimental systems where it does seem as if, you know, in many, many cases where you have two different order parameters, they seem roughly to vanish around the same point, and the intermediate temperature behavior doesn't seem to fall into any of these simple classes I've discussed.
And what is the superfluid order parameter in terms of that original Hamiltonian?
It's just B. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the Bose condensate. It's, in this case, it's very simple.
Well, speaking, the left hand side is like ordered, right?
What? Well, it's superfluid is ordered. It has a broken symmetry in anyone's.
What's the question?
Well, zero temperature.
Yeah,
zero temperature.
Oh. Right. Oh, that what you meant. Yeah. So when I'm referring to zero temperature, but the finite temperature part is just, I view finite temperature just, you know, the unavoidable ugliness we have to look at to do experiments, but the interesting stuff is going on. Sorry. But there's a lot of interesting physics there, of course. Sorry. For this discussion. Okay. All right. So can you have such a transition, and I hopefully have convinced you all. If you did, it would be highly unusual and certainly not expected.
Couldn't you, just a stupid question,
right? Yeah.
You have two symmetries that have a Hamiltonian, which is a translational invariance and the U1 phase.
Exactly. So two distinct symmetries which have nothing to do with each other.
Can I have a superfluid phase where Bi on the even sides is non-zero?
Yeah, so that would be a case with two transitions. Then you have a coexistence.
That's a coexistence.
Yeah. Then you have a phase, you have a superfluid.
Which breaks both.
That's right, exactly. That's this possibility with two, then there would be a superfluid phase, a superfluid coexisting CdW order, charge density wave, and an insulator. And the point is that the first transition from superfluid to where the translational symmetry breaking occurs is just, that's the order parameter, translational symmetry breaking. It would have Landau exponents for that. And the second one would be a superfluid transition. I mean, they're small corrections, but that's the basic picture. So now, the question is generically, can you get from an insulator to a superfluid and an insulator that breaks symmetry? So for this particular insulator, it's not quite clear whether you can. But there's another insulator one can imagine of boson that half filling, which I now want to draw, for which we are fairly certain that such a transition is possible. Okay, so now there's another insulator one can imagine of boson that half filling, and I'll just draw a simple picture of it. The trouble with this state in some ways is that the bosons are just too strongly localized. You could easily imagine that that you're not really making optimum use of this hopping term. So you want bosons to hop at least a little bit, but still keep them apart from each other. And one way you can do that is have them hop on two sides. So you put the bosons on a bond rather than a site. Okay. So what I mean by this is simply, if I call this site 1, site 2, this is just the bonding orbital, b dagger 1 plus b dagger 2. So here's a caricature for insulating wave function where the bosons are localized, but not so strongly localized on bonds. So here's another a guess for what an insulator might look like. It also breaks translational symmetry, as it must, but it breaks in a slightly different pattern. So the space group, all the group theory will be slightly different of the order parameter here as opposed to the order parameter there. Okay. But the thing about this state is that now I can ask, suppose I got this state. Now I ask the question, can I melt this particular order? And if I melt it, do I get a superfluid in a second order transition? So to do that in the same strategy I followed for the integer filling, what I should do is then ask, what are some of the excitations of this state? How do I create excitations about this insulator? What are my particles and what are my holes?
They're also doubly degenerate, right? Because you can check it.
There's fourfold degenerate. this one is two-fold degenerate, this is four-fold. You can also rotate it by 90 degrees.
And you can't rotate it inside there?
Okay, I'm just talking about the global symmetry. So certainly this thing you could imagine is, if it's equally likely to be here and here, then that's a different state called the Plaquette state, and that's also another possibility. And everything I'm saying will also hold for that state. So there's another state where you put two bosons on a square. This also has a four-fold degeneracy. I'm just going to focus on this for simplicity, but this is kind of the pattern.
This is your candidate for which state now?
For an insulator here.
This could have this kind of thing going on in the superfluid too, though.
Well, let me just. The question I want to ask is: suppose I want an insulator which breaks constitutional symmetry, and I want to ask, can I go to a superfluid in continuously?
Okay. A uniform superfluid.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
yes.
Okay. Uniform. Okay. So that's why I said it could have an inner. That would be just boring by definition. Okay.
Checkerboard case. If I assume the bosons become hardcore and represent them as spin halves, then I'm going from an XY phase to a Z-ordered phase.
That's right. That's
right. I expect one point in the middle that has Heisenberg symmetry.
Not generically. Only for certain Hamiltonians.
Okay, only for certain Hamiltonians. So the idea is that there's not going to be any fine-tuning like that.
That's right. Yeah.
Why don't you consider the checkerboard made of the edges, like a compromise between these pictures?
You could do that. That would have, an eight-fold degeneracy and so on. I'm saying all kinds of complicated patterns are possible. This is really the simplest. And everything, all the more complicated ones, everything I'm going to say will work too. So let me.
All of them will be insulators.
Yes. Yeah. And also, this scenario for a transition superfluid will also hold. The checkerboard is special. I mean, you get a slightly different theory. But anyway. Okay. So what are the excitations of this state? Well, remember you have one boson here hopping in this bonding state. Well, to create an excitation, you got to move a boson, move it somewhere else. So imagine, so one way to do that is let me just take this thing here. Well, move the boson over. So let's see, you got these things here. Say maybe here. Okay, suppose I did that. Roughly speaking. So what I've got here, well, let me just look at this part. So I've removed one boson, sorry. Hold on a second. Sorry, I should have practiced these pictures. Okay. So remember, I had one boson per bond. So let me just remove the boson. So it's gone. Now, once that boson is gone, I'm left with two empty sites. Now I can imagine these two sites are really free to move apart. So let me just imagine they do that. So when they do that, I get one here, and then one empty site over here that I won't draw. So locally, I have just one site here. I have to create them in pairs, but I have only one site sitting here, and imagine the other part, other guy has gone away. So what's the charge of this excitation? Well, since I have bosons, one half per site, the boson number of this defect is 1/2. So I have half a boson here. And in fact, the other partner is another half boson, which will be sitting on the opposite sublattice. So here, the excitation.
The main more tension there, so they're not ready for
you. Yeah, yes, okay.
Where is the one?
It's off the board, but it's somewhere here. Okay, here.
No, that's not the half, but where's the boson that you're removing?
I just took it out. Okay, I can.
Actually, it's on your third column.
I can put it over here, and then I'll get two. So these are two holes. I have two types of holes. So here, minus half, you're right. I have minus half of boson here, minus half here, and then I have somewhere else a plus half and a plus half. So really, I've created, if I want to be charge neutral, I've created four excitations. Two minus halves here and two plus halves somewhere else. So if I follow the same strategy, I'm coming to someone's, Roderick's question in a minute. If I follow the same strategy of writing down a field theory for these excitations, running out of time, then I would say I need two relativistic bosons. bosons with charge plus minus a half. So I have a Bose field here, which I call phi A, and another Bose field there, which is sitting, this is the A sublattice, say, and there's another Bose field here, which is phi B. And my original boson, roughly speaking, B, has become phi A times phi B. It's, when I removed one boson, I had two half bosons left, and these can, in principle, move apart. So the boson is fractionalized into half constituents. Well, not quite, as Roderick pointed out, because if I now look at this state, you know, the fact that I drew this order implied that there was some energy for lining up the bonds in this irregular pattern. That's why they lined up. Now if I look at what happens between the A and the B, right in between, these bosons are not, these bonds are not lined up at all. So you're obviously costing some energy. So there's some finite, there's a string tension. So in the E-mod insulator, phi A and phi B are confined. By the string tension, by the domain wall energy, sorry, in this language. So there's, you know, they're obviously not free, and we have to write down a theory that accounts for the fact that there is some domain wall energy, but it's also clear that the strength, the tension of the string depends upon how strong the order is, how strong the translational symmetry breaking is. The stronger the translational symmetry breaking, the higher the tension. So you could imagine a scenario, which is as you approach this critical point, where we know the translational symmetry is going to melt, that the string tension vanishes, and that these bosons really do become free. And that's, you know, there's a lot of detailed calculation one has to do, but that's basically the scenario. So you end up with a theory of these two Chandra-Hof bosons, which, as long as there's a broken symmetry, have a finite string tension. But then as they become lower in energy, the string tension becomes weaker and weaker. They deconfine at this point. But then on this side, when these phi is condensed, you go into a superfluid. Yeah?
What about some other low-energy excitation where you take two adjacent bonds of right.
Right? Excellent. So do I have 5-10 minutes more, David? I can stop here, but that's going to be, yeah, okay. All right, so the question, that's an excellent question. There are obviously other excitations, and these excitations are the excitations of the gauge theory that you need to confine these bosons. So clearly a theory of just the bosons is not sufficient. I need a gauge field to pair the bosons, and the fluctuation of the gauge field, the vacuum fluctuation of the gauge field, the gluons, will be these fluctuations. Okay. All right. So let me just. So in fact, the way I'm presenting this now, in fact, some of you already recognize this is similar to the dimer model that we're going to hear a lot about tomorrow of Fredkin and Kivelson, and so the derivation I'm presenting is going to follow some of their and also our ideas. Okay. So how do I go beyond this? So what I want to know, I don't know theory for this. For these two types of bosons, and also include the fluctuation of these bosons on different sites, the confining force, and the onset of superfluidity. So that's a tall order, and it's rather complicated business. But in the end, you can encapsulate all that physics in a single action. So, all right. So let me try and do that. So let's see. All right, first let me just do it naively, ignoring this issue of the excitation of the vacuum itself. As you pointed out, the vacuum with no bosons is already non-trivial here. So we have to worry about that a bit. And the vacuum, in fact, breaks symmetry. There's four different vacua, and I have to know I have four vacua, not just one. Let me just ignore that for a moment and just talk about you know, how would I write down the theory for these bosons consistent with what I know so far? So when I do this decomposition of my physical boson splitting into two, I immediately see that, writing down things this way, that I've now introduced a gauge symmetry that I didn't have when I started out, because I can now, of course, make a gauge transformation. Which doesn't change any physical observable. The only thing I can do is remove bosons one at a time, not half at a time. And so any theory for the phi A's must be invariant under this transformation. So there is a U1 gauge symmetry, in fact, a U1 gauge force that must connect these bosons. I'm looking very coarse-grained here. If you want the details, just thinking in the level of Coley particles here. You know, I removed this B boson I'm thinking of as removing, I removed it in a bond. There's some form factor there, of course, but yeah. So in the long distance limit, if I want to write down some excitation of these bosons, then they must be coupled by a gauge force. So I would imagine writing on theory with some gauge field, U1 gauge field A mu, where phi A has charge plus 1, and phi B has charge plus minus 1. So these are charge, this charge is a fictitious charge, is a physical boson number charge, which is 1/2 for each of them. This plus 1 and minus 1 is a fictitious charge associated with this internal gauge symmetry. Plus u, you know, phi to the fourth of various term. So I could imagine writing down this kind of gauge theory action, and which is certainly consistent with this gauge invariance. And now as I change the value of r, when the phi a, phi b condense, I'm condensing these bosons, well, the charge 1/2, so what? It's still a superfluid that I'd obtain that way. But this approach, you know, has an important failing, which is that it doesn't account for the fact, you know, where's the other order parameter, the translational symmetry breaking? That's simply not accounted for here. So to do that, I have to really step back a bit and think a little bit about the vacuum from which this all came. And so really, I have to go back and think about just the case without any bosons, where the ground state had this additional degree of freedom, where these bonds were, or these dimers were able to resonate between different arrangements. Okay, so, and I also imagine adding terms like f mu nu squared that are consistent with the gauge symmetry. Okay, so what's missing? Well, it's, and how do I account for these dimers? So, to do that, I guess you have, the simplest way to see it is to try to come up with some more physical interpretation of what this gauge field is. Well, this gauge field, you can see after thinking about it a little bit, is basically the number operator for these dimers. So if I just look at the vacuum, so you've got, I imagine I introduce a number operator telling me where these bosons or these dimers are sitting. So let me call this site R. So then I have a number operator on this site, and this number operator NR is basically plus minus 1, this is a sublattice factor, times e to the I A sub R. So where A has x and y components, depending on if the bond is horizontal or vertical. So if I make this definition, you'll see why this is reasonable. The number operator is basically the electric field, which is, let me step back, I'm not saying this clearly. So I introduce kind of an angular variable which sits on a circle on every bond, and that angular variable, there's an angle A sub R, and a number operator, the conjugate variable E sub R, which have the usual canonical commutation relations. This is the momentum, and this is the angular variable, particle moving in a circle. This E sub R, which is the electric field or the number operator of this boson. So n sub r is minus plus or minus 1 of e sub r. All right, so the reason for doing this is that there's an important constraint in the system that you've got exactly one boson coming into each side, or exactly one dimer coming into each side. And when you formulate things this way, you can then see that that constraint is nothing but Gauss's law, that del dot E turns out to be plus minus 1. So even before you put in any bosons, there's in fact some matter in the system. If you put any of these excitations, there's matter in the system, the existence of these dimers sitting around. And these dimers act as charges, plus minus 1, on the two sublattices. So there's plus charges here and minus charges there. Okay, so now you see why I want to do this, because now when I remove a particle, I'm creating a phi A and phi B charges plus and minus 1, which are now exposed. So that's exact. So this will be, when I include these excitation phi A and phi B, then I have to also allow for here for the physical n sub A, I think I forgot, it's n sub A minus n sub B. So you get a Gauss's law constraint, and that's exactly what tells you that this number operator here is the electric field associated with the charges that you introduced associated with these holes. Okay, so that's, you can really do that much more carefully than I've done here, but it gives you a flavor for what's required. So what's missing in this theory then is the fact that you're not really working in a vacuum. There are these charges, background charges, sitting there on the lattice. So there's another term here, which I'll just call I J background mu A mu. And this J background mu is basically this plus minus 1 over here, that you've got one dimer coming to every side, is delta mu tau times plus minus 1. And that's the complete theory. So this turns out to be the key ingredient, in fact, that allows everything to work in a way that I don't have time to go into. But what you can then see when you account for these background charges is that when you're in the phase where R is large, where, of course, the phi A's are incredibly massive and it can be removed, so you're very far away from the superfluid, then in that phase, these background charges lead to a background configuration of electric fields, which breaks the translational symmetry of the lattice associated with these four different states that I was showing you. On the other hand, when the phi is condensed, effectively these background charges get screened out, and you get a superfluid that doesn't break any translational symmetries. So there's a lot of technical stuff that took over 10 years to understand as to how exactly the things vary near the critical point. But in the end, we're fairly confident that, at least in this one simple case, that there is this exotic critical point where these half charges deconfine, and you have a continuous transition between two different broken symmetries. Absolutely. Well, I mean, the hard part is knowing how to go from the lattice to the continuum. That's
a continuum. There is a continuum.
Yes. Yeah. There is universality, but in fact, what we're working on now is looking at this thing and say, at filling P over Q, and for each Q, there's a different theory. There's a different continuum theory which you have to work out very carefully. But there's many other possibilities, it seems, of critical points in this class. So what at least we find exciting about this is this leads, first of all, there's a whole new class of quantum critical points, but you don't have classical analogs. And it also leads very naturally to strong effects in this quantum critical region, where the effects of fluctuations are not in any sense small as they are in the epsilon expansion and in a variety of quantities. Yeah.
Beard, do you have any feeling for when you get this very exciting physics and when you get just the boring old two different critical points?
Not really. I mean, this is, I think, a very important question, of course, that we just, it would be good to have more numerical studies of exactly when this happens. I mean, I think we now certainly have rather good evidence, as I should have mentioned this earlier, in work of Anders Sandvik, of a whole class of boson models, where this, the ground state of the insulator does indeed look like this. And in his numerics, you know, it could, there's either a second or a very weakly first order transition.
Sudhir, can I interpret this as a situation when you rewrite your theory in the appropriate variables, like this gauge theory, it becomes an old boring fixed point?
No. Okay. I mean, it's all tied up with this term here. If you didn't have this term, in some sense, you could. But if you didn't have this term, you don't have one of the order parameters. See, this is needed to get the fact that the fluctuations of the gluons already lead to a new order parameter. Without this, you know, you need the background matter field for all of that to happen. Yeah.
You talked about these particular excitations, but say on a given plot, kept the two horizontal ponds become two vertical. Why aren't those excitations?
Well, that's what's described by this term here. So you know, that's the gluon effectively. That's right there.
You said you have a lot of experimental examples where you had the continuous phase change
in two different
programs. Stewart's things. Yeah, Stewart Braun, the spin piles compound that seems to be happening there. I mean, you could say in the high TC, you know, there seems to be a superfluid insulator transition, possibly broken transitional symmetry, charge order, spin order, all roughly happening at the same point. Now, of course, that could be to other reasons, but certainly, I think it's you have multiple competing states, which you seem to have in many systems. I think it's a common phenomenon that these transitions all seem to be roughly in the same region. Now, even if ultimately it splits into two, one could hope that this kind of physics is important at higher energy scales.
I was just hoping you had a whole class.
I have to think a bit more. I mean, there are other examples, I think, but those are the two I had immediately top of my mind. Yeah.
This is maybe what I comment on the theory, but you should want to have multiple states or several order parameters. Don't you usually have first order transition?
Well, you could. I can't rule that out, of course. Yeah.
Many order parameter often happens, so usually nature just has first order.
Well, this is related to Steve's question. I mean, I would, yes, nature could be that boring, but the idea here is that there are still many open puzzles for systems which seem to be near multiple order states, and what's clearly needed are some radical proposals for new types of critical points, and here's one.
You also might want to point out it's a critical point that has an eta that's very different from zero.
Which, right.
You know, the other critical points don't have any ones.
Right, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
What is eta?
What?
How big is it? How big is it?
They got a 0.6 or something, right?
Yeah, so.
Okay.